My name's Matt. I have the privilege of being the minister here at Maybridge. Lovely to be with you. If you are a guest, if you're visiting, please do come and say hello to me after the service. Would love to meet with you. But as a church, we tend to do a series over weeks or months every Sunday, looking at a topic or a book of the Bible. And I've not been excited as this for a new series for a long time. And that's because our series are really long quite often. But for the next 8 weeks, this one's only 8 weeks, all right? I'm going to be speaking every week, you lucky people, on this topic, how to be church. How to be church. And the whole thing is based on one book of the Bible, a book that we call 1 Thessalonians. And why are we doing it this way? Well, within this letter, which was written to a church, it says this phrase. It says, you became a model. This is the only time in the whole Bible it says that. This church in the city of first century Thessalonica was a model church. Not perfect, it wasn't perfect, but it was a model church. In other words, somebody saw how they were doing church and what it was like, and it was so good that someone pointed to it and said, that is what it's supposed to be like when we do church properly, they said to these people. And so for us, we can look at this letter in detail because it doesn't just say that the church was a model. It tells us how they ended up that way, which is extremely convenient and helpful. And as we go through these 8 weeks, we're going to find some of it, I hope, inspiring, some of it challenging in what it does and does not say about church. But before we dive in, here's a little bit of the backstory. Sometime in the late AD 40s, about 15 years after the resurrection of Jesus, two significant leaders called Paul and Silas traveled to the city of Thessalonica to tell people about him. A number of people in this relatively small city became Christians, and they formed an ecclesia or gathering. And after 2,000 years, we've got lots of assumptions about church, but in the first century, church was new. It was brand new. And it was this messy but committed group of Christians working out, well, how do we do this then? How do we follow Jesus then? How do we make this look? And a few years after they'd left the city, Paul and Silas and their friend Timothy write to this church. They write a letter, which is what we now call 1 Thessalonians. And this letter does three things that show us, that means that we know this is what church is supposed to look like, okay? So if you could just put these on the screen, Becca. Okay, firstly in this letter, it looks back to the good things that had happened there, the things that had set the church up to thrive. Then it gives a picture of their present reality. So how these people were growing, they were growing quite nicely in following Jesus, and we get to see how that happened. And thirdly, it looks forward to what the Thessalonian church could do in the future to continue to be in good health. And it looks even further ahead to the end of the world, which was supposed to shape how Christians would live all the way until whenever that day happens. Put all this together, we've got here the New Testament's best description of a thriving, healthy church from less than 20 years before Jesus' death and resurrection. All those centuries of Christians making mistakes and getting the wrong end of the stick hadn't happened yet. This is what we're going to see, basically, is what God intended church to be like. And this is how we're going to walk through it, okay? These are the themes that come out as we go through each of the next 8 weeks. We get to see the identity, the message, the culture, the priorities, the leadership, the relationships, the purposes, the habits of this church. My hope is that in doing this, it will encourage us and challenge us and help us put everything that we're doing into the bigger story of what God is doing. So today we're going to begin with one verse. Don't worry, we're going to speed up after today. This is how it all begins. This is the introduction, 1 verse 1, okay? Paul, Silas, and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians in God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ, grace and peace to you. That's all I'm going to talk to you about today, okay? This ancient letter about church does not begin with steeples or songs or strategies, but an expression of identity. Before anything else, the authors remind the Christians in Thessalonica, just ordinary people like you and me, who they are. But what do we mean by identity? Why does it matter at the beginning of a letter about what church is supposed to be like? Well, it seems to be generally accepted that by identity, we mean who we are, the heart of who we are, our true selves, the thing that is most us. And then with some sort of understanding of identity in place, we then play the different roles of life, you know, a worker, a friend, a partner, a parent, and so on. But we do those with a sense of self. And our sense of self is, it's a mashup maybe of our desires and our values and our commitments and our purpose. In many cultures, the identity of an individual is understood in terms of the wider community. So you might say, well, I'm part of this tribe, or I belong to this nation. And it's not mainly about you personally, it's about how you're part of the whole. Our culture is completely the other way around. And we are bombarded with messages that reinforce the idea that you, the individual, are the center of everything. Think how many adverts and TV shows tell you exactly that through story and persuasion. As the author Tim Keller writes, modern culture says your identity and your self-worth is not based on sublimating your interests and your desires for the good of your family. No, identity happens, you become yourself when you assert your desires, assert your interests, you live in the way you want to in spite of what your family or anybody else tells you. Sound familiar? It should. We are so soaked in this way of seeing things, we often, in our culture, can't understand any other way of being. We can't imagine something else. And so we live in a time where identity is super important and even very controversial. There are emotional, very emotional conversations around everything from gender politics to which sports team that you follow. Everybody is desperate to mean something, to be significant, and yet to fit in at the same time. But for many of us, the search for identity usually comes out, I think, in quieter ways. We might try to find our identity in being intelligent, or being wealthy, or being kind, or being good at board games, or being a great musician, or a great parent. There's a million things that we latch onto and say, that's me. That's my core identity. That defines me. I'm that or I'm nothing. And we might never talk about it or even acknowledge it, but it's there, driving how we live. We might try to find our identity in those things and feel like we're falling short, and then we end up in feeling sad and insecure. The individual, you, as the center of your life and ambitions. But hold on, we might ask, is that a problem? So what if we're told stories about our identity by our culture? So what if we're told that we're the center? What harm does it cause to really focus on you, on yourself? Well, if we try to get our identity from our achievements or our opinions, we create a number of problems for ourselves, and here are some of them. Firstly, a self-created identity leads to deep insecurity. When we create an identity for ourselves, we will always find it subject to the changing winds of opinion and feeling and ideology. So, for example, if I was to build my identity, my sense of what's me and what matters about me, on my intelligence, that might feel good for a while, especially if I'm around people I think are less intelligent than I am. But what happens, if I'm doing that, what happens if I meet somebody who's more intelligent than me, which I have to say happens to me all of the time? Or what happens if I have an illness and my intelligence diminishes? Or what happens if I fail an exam or something? To put my identity into my intelligence would be to build it on something that is fragile and unstable. It would need constant affirmation and mollycoddling. And you can apply that to anything that you come up with that is not an identity found in God. Every other option for our core identity will create problems in some way that leaves us feeling deeply insecure. Secondly, a self-fulfilling identity leads to ongoing confusion. We are often told to build our identity on our desires And in our culture, there's a big emphasis on defining yourself by your sexual desires in particular. Whatever we feel we want to do sexually should be expressed. It should be the most important thing about us, apparently. But our desires, sexual and otherwise, are often in contradiction. What if I want to sleep around with whoever comes along and I also want to be in a committed relationship with my wife? I can't do both. Got to pick a desire. How do I know which is the real me? What if I want to lose weight, but I also really want to eat pies? What if I want to stay up late and watch a film, but I also want a long night's sleep? It's too simple and not helpful to say we should get our identity from following our desires, because our desires are often in opposition and they tell us all sorts of things that change all the time. Finding our identity in what we want is just completely confusing. Thirdly, though, a self-focused identity leads to social isolation. In a time and place where the emphasis on your own desires is so strong that it's assumed we shouldn't defer to someone else, we shouldn't tolerate not getting our way, shouldn't compromise so much of who we are, what do we do? In a society of people focused on the individual, nobody is equipped to thrive. If I'm focused on me and everyone else around me is focused on themselves, how do we build a rich community of mutual support? The most individualistic society that has ever been, ours, is also the most lonely. The statistics around loneliness and depression bear this out. What we need is an identity that somehow holds the tension of us being valuable individuals, but also making sense only in community. There's only one person I know that can give us that and hold the tension perfectly. Fourthly, a self-defined identity leads, ironically, to a loss of self. The great irony of trying to craft an identity for yourself, free from other people, is that it's impossible to do it. Our careful efforts to present ourselves as we'd like to be seen and gain the sense of value that we crave so much is far more influenced by the approval of other people than we'd like to believe. The sociologist Charles Horton Cooley, after a lot of study, concluded this. We develop our concept of self by watching how other people react to different versions of ourselves that we present. In other words, more than we'd like to think, we end up being an avatar of what other people want us to be. We become a compilation of what people say or want. Like it or not, we lose our sense of self rather than gain it. With all of this happening, all this influence on us, we need a better place to find our identity. Back to that opening line, 1 Thessalonians 1 verse 1. Paul the author, well, Paul and Silas and Timothy the authors, position the church in a way that informs everything else that follows. This little group of new Jesus followers in Thessalonica were in God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. Now don't miss this. This is a statement of core identity. This church in Thessalonica were not just a bunch of people who agreed on some theological ideas. They were in God in some ways. Let's break that down. They're in God the Father. Of all the many things that could be said about God, top billing, core identity of his people, is that he's their Father. Now, many of us will have had different experiences of an earthly dad, some good and some bad. But whatever our experiences, we know a good dad surely is a good thing. And God is the greatest dad. Yes, he's the judge and he's the king and many other things, and he's very different from us. But if you're part of his people, he's dad. He's dad. And that means you're somehow within God's purposes and protection. The very first thing Paul writes to the Thessalonians is a reminder that they are first and foremost people with a heavenly dad. They are not defined, number one, by their theological distinctives or their midweek activities or their position on lots of political issues. They're defined, number one, by the fact that God the Father is their dad. And if you're part of his people, he's your dad too. He loves you and wants the best for you, and everything he says is for your good. But the way that God the Father shows that he loves us is actually made flesh in the other part of our identity that this passage lays out. The Thessalonians were also in Jesus. And Paul calls Jesus by a grand title, the Lord Jesus Christ. He uses all, you know, three different words. He could have just used one of those words, but he chooses three. And each of those words is important. It's another expression of identity. Firstly, to call Jesus Lord means the writers of this letter truly believed, less than two decades after his life, ministry, and death, that Jesus really was God incarnate. This was a remarkable thing for any first century Jew to write. This is not just, oh, ancient people believe this stuff. No. It would have taken a lot of persuasion for anyone to believe that a man was God. In Jesus, God entered our world. But to have other people believe that, well, that was incredible. I often think back to the story I heard of a man called Jang Jin-sung. And Jang Jin-sung escaped North Korea back in 2004. And he was working for the government in an important position. Spent his whole life in North Korea. Everybody he knew, everybody, every media outlet, everybody told him that Kim Jong-il, the leader at the time, was a god. And after he escaped, Jin-sung said this: "I didn't just think Kim Jong-il was great. I thought he had divine powers. In North Korea, the deification of the Kim family is systematic. In my job at the UFD, I wrote poetry and literature to earn sympathy for the state and our leader. Kim Jong-il loved one of the poems so much, I was invited to meet him. It was the greatest honor a man could hope for. But when I met him, my vision was shattered. I realized he was human like me and started to question the flawless narrative around him." Consider this. Jang Jin-sung spent his whole life being told from every angle that Kim Jong-il was divine. A quick meeting with a real man and he thought, no, he isn't. Jesus entered a culture that was pre-programmed to believe that nobody could possibly be divine, and hundreds of people who spent time with him concluded that he was. That's remarkable. People began to suspect it when Jesus performed miracles, but when he resurrected from death, they were certain. Hundreds of people. He's God. And we're with that Jesus. We're in that Jesus. But secondly, Jesus was the familiar name everyone knew him by, the carpenter's son from Nazareth. In other words, he was human. It's one of us. People met him, interacted, heard what he had to say, asked questions, saw miracles. This was flesh and blood in front of them, not an idea or a philosophy, but a person. A person. But the word, the name Jesus, also means salvation. His name was human and personal, but it also carries in it the idea of some sort of rescue, of being saved from something, of being secure. And so when Paul writes that we're in him, he's saying that this person whose very name and identity is about saving people encloses us in and keeps us safe. We're within his safety net. And thirdly, Christ was the translation of the Greek Christos from the Hebrew Messiah. The Old Testament, for centuries earlier, promised a Messiah would come to fix the world's problems. And the early Christians, most of whom were Jewish, were people who came to believe, no, Jesus, he is that Messiah, it's him. Everything about his life and his teaching and his death and his resurrection was like a big neon sign saying, it's this guy, it's him. And so it's not by accident that Paul uses those three words together. Jesus is God, Jesus is human, and Jesus is the access point to salvation for everybody else. Imagine that being your name or your job title. And so Jesus' own identity, which is secure and permanent and amazing, is the foundation for our identity as his people. And we've all, you know, we're all unique. We've got our own unique ways and our quirks and our talents and our dreams and so on. But our core identity is that God, our Father, declares us valuable and worth loving through his Son, the promised Messiah, the real life flesh and blood person, the carrier of salvation, God incarnate. And so for normal people, like first century Thessalonians, or 21st century people like us, people with normal lives and jobs and problems and families and so on, find their identity, core identity, in Jesus. through all his letters in the New Testament, Paul, one of the authors of this, talks about being in Jesus again and again and again. He's obsessed with it, basically. He uses the term, or some variation of it, 143 times in his letters. That's because he knows being in Jesus is exactly who we are and what we need. Being in Jesus is the way the Father who loves us made that love tangibly real in our world. And so here's why this expression of identity is so important. When we begin this, you know, number of weeks looking at this letter, all the great material that we're going to see that follows about how to live your life, where to find hope, what church is supposed to be about, comes from this. We're in Jesus. Without being in Jesus, most of what it says is just sort of nice-sounding moral and spiritual advice with a few theological ideas thrown in for good measure. But with Jesus, in Jesus, it's a new way of seeing life and the universe and even how you see yourself. The church and each person who calls it home, if we were just to take hold of this, that finding your identity in Jesus is the foundation, so much else would fall into place. It's the basis of a healthy church, of a healthy people. It's exactly what we need to hear to kick off this 8 weeks. But just for a few minutes, just to get really specific about this, here's what finding your core identity in Jesus does, okay? The transformative effects of finding your identity in Jesus. Firstly, it's received, not achieved. When we're in Jesus, he's achieved everything important. We receive an identity. We don't build one. We don't have to make a name for ourselves. We don't need to. We don't need to attain an identity with Jesus. We're given one, and then we live it out. You don't have to strive to be enough. How many people need to hear that this morning? Jesus was enough for you already. Feel the physical pressure lift off your shoulders. It's genuine. It's received from him, not achieved by us. Second is solid, not shaky. If your identity comes from within and your own feelings or from what other people have to say, it will never be solid. It will always be susceptible to change. And there really is no way out of that unless God gives you an identity. You will always be pushed around by feelings and what other people say or how well you think you're doing on the day. But if you're a follower of Jesus, you have an identity that can't be shaken or taken. Your behavior, your emotions, your ups and downs are not going to change it. It's like standing on a rock rather than sinking sand. And if you've got that, you can get on with life from a place of deep security. Your identity rooted in God's love for you, what he says, what Jesus has done, it can't be compromised by you or by what anyone else says. How good is that? Anybody? It's also practical, not theoretical. Think about this. 1 Thessalonians begins, like a lot of letters, with the names of the authors, Paul, Silas, and Timothy. Now, Paul was by far the biggest name of those three. In historical terms, Paul is one of the 10 most influential people who's ever lived. He just is, right? He's enormously intelligent. He's very persuasive, very strong-willed. Silas and Timothy are basically his sidekicks, okay? And Timothy was a much younger man. We know that. So at the time, Paul could have begun this letter and he could have written, it's from Paul, right? He could have written with a posture that said, I'm a big name in Christianity, okay? So you'd better listen to what I have to say. But he doesn't. And it seems like a small thing, but by including his friends in the authorship, he's giving them equal credit in this letter. And all the way through the letter, he addresses the Thessalonians as equals, which was weird for a leader to do at the time. Because Paul's identity is in Jesus, there's no need to assert authority or superiority, show off how clever he is. He's not got that anxious desperation for prestige and respect. He's secure. And that's what an identity in Jesus does. You don't need to strain yourself showing that you're capable or valuable in some way. You're significant and you are who you are in him. You can relax. And this will show up in the way that you are with other people. The more securely your sense of identity is placed in Jesus, the more secure a person you'll be in general. The more securely your sense of identity is placed in Jesus, the more secure a person you will be in general. And last thought, it's we, not me. This letter was written not to a respected church leader or a few of the sort of influential people. It was written to a whole church. In our modern way of understanding identity, it's about you, how you feel, what you achieve. But church is an interdependent community. Every individual matters. Everyone is important, but we only make sense together. And this really challenges a lot of modern thinking about Christianity. Like we can do it on our own. Or you know, sometimes you hear people say, well, I've got my own private personal walk with God. I don't need everybody else. Sort of detached, trying to do Christianity on your own. That is all a modern invention and it makes no sense whatsoever. God's intention was that we be a group, a multi-generational, diverse people of love and support and challenge, which although, of course, it's imperfect, is the closest thing we get this side of eternal life to a home. That was what we were made for. We need each other. We can't be followers of Jesus without each other. Our identity is not me, it's we. I only make sense with all of you, and hopefully vice versa. So we've started this 8 weeks on 1 Thessalonians with one verse, all are about our identity, and it's the foundation for everything we're about to see in the weeks ahead. But can you see, even from how we've begun, the driving thing in what it means to be church, a model church in fact, is not, well, I do some religious bits, or the Sunday gatherings, and there's midweek meetings and all that sort of thing. It's who we are in Jesus. All the activity comes out of that. And we'll get to that because identities have to be lived out, and that's what happens with the rest of this series. But you know, if you're sat here, maybe you're not a Christian, you're not a follower of Jesus yourself, this is open to everybody. The invitation is for everyone because it's not something you do. It's not your personality, your accomplishments, your history. God has an identity for you, one that is free and permanent and wonderful with his community of people. And it's brilliant. Let's take hold of it. Let's run with it.